This is Studio 360, live at the Aspen Ideas Festival. My next guest, digital pioneer John Seely Brown, is one of our senior technology sages. Think love child of Thomas Edison and Yoda. But for 23 years, he was a major figure at Xerox's legendary Palo Alto Research Center, the last decade as its director. Please welcome John Seely Brown. So, Park, Xerox Park, as it's sort of arrived in legend, sounds like it was a kind of wonderful time of the inmates running the asylum in the best sense. Was it?
Well, absolutely. It was an amazing place. It was very small. It was 250 people. We wanted to keep it small because then we could have all these different disciplines. We had physicists, engineers, mathematicians, computer scientists, a lot of psychologists. So it was kind of magical in terms of this cross-disciplinary approach to trying to go to the root of problems. We also had this kind of belief that we should build whatever we eat. And so we never bought any of our computers. We actually built everything. And that's what enabled us to kind of really get ahead of the power curve, because if we can imagine it, we could build it.
Before we talk more about your miraculous time at the Park Center, I want to show a clip from a TV movie from a couple of years ago. It was called Pirates of Silicon Valley. What you're about to see is Anthony Michael Hall as Bill Gates and Noah Wyle as Steve Jobs. And Jobs in this scene is confronting Gates about how Microsoft Windows is a ripoff of the way that the Mac desktop looked and worked.
What is this? This is like doing business with, it's like a praying mantis, huh? You get seduced and then eaten alive afterwards? Get real, will you? You and I are both like guys that have this rich neighbor, Xerox. It left the door open all the time. And you go sneaking in to steal a TV set. Only when you get there, you realize that I got there first. I got the loot, Steve!
Now, that was the actors playing Gates and Jobs talking about the graphical user interface, which is the point-and-click software design that replaced DOS in the 80s. And the rich neighbor they're talking about, of course, was your colleagues. Is that a more or less fair depiction of what happened and what did happen?
Well, I don't know about the conversation between Bill and Steve right there, but you know, the sense is that if you go back to that period of time, you know, quite honestly, Park and also Steve, we were considered strange people. You know, when I went to work there, I don't think I owned a pair of shoes. And I don't think any of the people I ever hired owned a pair of shoes.
And just for our listeners at home, you have some very nice leather shoes on now.
Right.
To make that clear.
I have slowly, partially grown up. But the fact is that it was an amazing sandbox and playground. And we were a bunch of hobbyists.
Hackers in the good sense.
Hackers in the best sense, actually. And it was, I think, a little bit hard for the suits to take seriously either Steve Jobs or us. So you had a little bit of a cognitive dissonance between the weirdos in the West and the straights in the East. But the other thing to kind of understand is that Xerox did something actually was kind of brilliant, because they said, you know, maybe this hobbyist stuff could turn out to be something interesting. So why don't we let Steve come and walk all over Park and come in But why don't we just buy a small part of Apple at the same time, which is what we did. And that part has never been covered very well in the press.
So the tragedy, the famous tragedy that you didn't get enough credit for the mouse or for the user interface is not as tragic as...
I don't think it's anywhere near as tragic as it sounds, although it makes great, great stories. By the way, you know, the many, many things we invented, the mouse we stole, kind of like Steve. So we actually borrowed that from SRI, Doug Engelbart, who was kind of the master genius behind some of these ideas even before us. We actually figured out how to make it really work, but nevertheless, that idea came from him. We also brought in a lot of 15-year-old kids at the same time, because actually kids give us a lot of ideas today of how to do things. We'll get back to that.
Well, I want to ask you, I mean, what do you think of the hours, hundreds, thousands of hours that kids today spend playing video games? Is that a pernicious thing, or just their version of watching baseball that our parents did?
The catch in understanding games, and I used to write and talk a lot about how awful I thought video-based games were until I kind of had a very strange interactions and wonderful interactions with some kids that got me interested in doing kind of a reverse mentorship. And what I suddenly recognized is when I looking at video games, I just focused on the action of the game. But the richness of the game is never in the center of the game. The richness of what's going on is always the social life on the edge of the game, where these kids are finding tricks out, they're kind of figuring out how to trade information, they're sharing stuff all the time, they're building cliques to be able to kind of swap notes faster and so on. So it's quite a different thing than I first thought was really going on. But the other thing is that most people don't realize is, your kids are basically joining guilds. So if you play the World of Warcraft, which half the kids of your kids do, I guarantee you, you can't actually solve the quests that are required to succeed in the World of Warcraft unless you form a guild. So I talked to this kid and I said, I got to really know how do you think about, running, what's the constitution of your guild? And he said, well, first, John, I got to create a mission statement that defines my values. And then I got to make sure that I can communicate those values. And then what I have to do is figure out how to recruit people to join my guild, and then I got to train them. And then I got to build an apprenticeship program to bring newbies in. And then finally what I have to do is I really have to, in order to kind of retain these people, I have to really figure out how to do dispute adjudication all the time.
I'd rather just shoot people and monsters than do all that, I think, really.
Yeah, but that's the problem. I got to take you in there yet.
Wow.
Because a lot more things are actually going on. And that's, if you just listen to those skills, those are the skills of being a CEO of a startup. I mean, it is amazing. And I can tell you some of those guild masters have actually gone on to be able to do.
I am talking with John Seely Brown. He's the former chief scientist of Xerox and former director of Xerox Park. This is Studio 360 at the Aspen Ideas Festival.